Welcome. Welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning. Welcome you back. This is our first session of the spring semester, and after today, we have 12 more weeks in the semester, so to speak, and a lot of great speakers, interesting topics lined up. I think you've seen the February schedule. It is on the website. And so just to give you a taste of the sort of variety of speakers and topics we'll be covering, after today, next week, we'll hear from our very own Greg Tripoli of the Onondaga Historical Association, not just about the past of OHA and kind of the present, what they're doing, their entrepreneurial, but also the future and a new museum that is in the works. So that will be great. So that's next week. But this week, we ended last semester, if you remember, last year, December, hearing from State Senator John DeFrancisco. And we are opening this year's session with State Senator David Valesky. We haven't had Dave with us for a few years. We were talking a lot way back in the days of the dysfunctional Albany and the fixed Albany. So we're going to hear about where he's come so far. But to introduce him, I would like to introduce one of our newest TMR members is Pam Hunter. Pam is the regional director of the Epilepsy Foundation and involved in several other boards, the Syracuse Industrial Development Agency, Transitional Living Services, Home Aids, and then, of course, her political activities. So thank you, Pam.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning. I was pleased when Sandra called me as a longtime guest of TMR that I actually executed my membership, and I was pleased when she called and said, would you introduce Senator Valesky? And I said, of all people, I would be happy to do it. David has been a longtime friend, known him since his WCNY days. He was born and raised in Oneida. His wife, Julie, is lovely. She's a teacher. I have a whole bio that I could read about Senator Valesky, but instead of me up here talking, I would just like to introduce one of the biggest reformers in Albany right now, Senator David Valesky.
Thank you very much, Pam. And most important thing about that introduction was saying that my wife, Julie, is lovely. So thank you for saying that. I'm happy to be back. It is, and maybe it's very appropriate that I would be following Senator John DeFrancisco, always a tough act to follow, but given what is going on in Albany in terms of how we are working very closely together in a new majority coalition in the state Senate, I don't know if, Sandra, if you had planned it this way in terms of us going back to back, but it's certainly, I think it will dovetail quite nicely. What I want to do is talk about what is happening in Albany, what has changed, and a lot of significant change has happened in Albany most recently over the last several weeks, but really going back over the past couple of years, and tell you why I'm doing what I'm doing and why we are doing what we are doing in Albany, and hopefully that will shed some light on a really, I think, unique and different model of governing. I think we have perhaps finally come up with a way to govern for the people, by the people, and put to as great a degree as possible the hyper-partisan nature of politics that has gripped Albany for so long, or had gripped Albany for so long, and in many ways still does in Washington. Perhaps we've found a way to move beyond that. But to tell you how we've gotten where we are, I have to go back a while. And Sandra, you're right, I was here a few years ago and have been here a couple of years during my tenure, but I have to go all the way back to give you my perspective as to how the Senate has functioned, or maybe how the Senate hasn't functioned over the last several years, to really give you a sense of why we are where we are today. I am beginning my ninth year in the state Senate. Time does fly. Was first elected back in 2004 under some very unique circumstances, electoral circumstances. But to show you how odd things have been in Albany, the fact that I'm beginning my fifth term, my fifth two-year term in the state legislature, and I'm serving now with my fourth governor, four governors over 9 years. So that maybe in and of itself says a lot about what's been going on in Albany. But I want to sort of, as quickly as possible, take you through the previous 8 years and then spend a little time about what we're doing now over the next, in this new term of the legislature. So when I came in the Senate in 2005, of course, the Senate at the time was run by Senator Bruno. Complete control over everything that has to do with legislation and resources and getting anything done. And we all remember that. And in fact, we made a big deal about significant rules reform in the state Senate as a result of how the Senate had been run for many, many, many years. At the same time, we had the first governor that I served under, Governor Pataki, who was nearing the end of his three terms in office. And remember, this is a point in time when economically we were doing pretty well. This was before the national economic recession in the mid, about 2005, 2006. The state was doing well. The legislature, though, unfortunately, was continuing a budgetary pattern, a spending pattern, of really spending beyond our means. And in a governor, and at this point in time, it was clear that Governor Pataki was not running for re-election. So in many instances, the Senate and the Assembly formed the governing coalition of the day, and spending was really in many cases out of control, and that in part led to many of the fiscal problems we had later in the decade and certainly into this decade. 2006, Governor Pataki leaves, Governor Spitzer is elected, right? Very popular governor, high in the polls, sounds very familiar to today, right? Is going to reform Albany. And actually, I believe the slogan, Governor Spitzer's slogan was, on day one, everything changes. Remember that? Well, unfortunately, everything didn't change. And while there were great intentions and hopes and promises, the situation that developed rather quickly between then Governor Spitzer and the Senate, particularly Senator Bruno as a Senate leader with the state police and Trooper Gate and so on and so forth, the dysfunction that Albany had been known for only got worse. Governor Spitzer, as we know, only served for a little over a year, and then Governor Patterson, who was a former colleague of mine in the Senate and the Lieutenant Governor at the time, becomes governor. At the same time that Governor Patterson becomes governor, what happens? The worst economic crisis to confront the state and the nation in decades. In many ways, all of us from the state government perspective was completely unprepared to deal with that economic crisis. In the Senate, back to the Senate in 2008, for the first time in some 40 years, the Democrats took the majority. And really, you had to go all the way back to the early 1930s, with the exception of a two-year period in the mid-1960s. When the Democrats actually controlled the Senate. So we move into this situation, economic crisis, a Democratic conference dominated for the most part by New York City Democrats. And remember, the Assembly has been and continues to be overwhelmingly governed by Democrats. So now what happens? What does this mean politically? What does it mean governmentally? Well, in 2009 and 2010, we know that we, those of us who were in office at the time, saw the state Senate taken to new levels of dysfunction, right? Balancing the largest deficit that we've had in recent years, not through spending restraints, but through too many taxes, through out of control spending and expansion of programs at the same time that we had this political change. Next, we have what? A coup in the state Senate, right? That in effect shuts down the entire Senate and really the entire legislature for 5 weeks during the summer of 2009. Nothing gets done. There's no cooperation whatsoever among, at the time, the two parties, Senate Democrats and Senate Republicans. And the height, I think, of dysfunction over those 2 years, the fact that we as state senators, for the first time in over 100 years, actually had to take the step of expelling a member of the state Senate, which I think as we look back, it has really become a symbol of the dysfunction that existed for those 2 years. And so you might think, you know, why? Why is that the case? All right, you've got a Senate Democratic Conference, a Senate Republican Conference. Why was there no cooperation? Why was there no working together? The most significant mistake that we made when we were in charge is there was no attempt to reach across the party lines, to work in a cooperative fashion with the Republicans in the Senate, to actually move forward an agenda. It takes 32 votes to pass anything in the Senate. At that time, there were 32 Democrats and 30 Republicans. There were a number of controversial pieces of legislation that came up. There was no bipartisan cooperation, something that I have always believed is critical in advancing a legislative agenda. None whatsoever. And perfect example that I'll use, and there are many, when the Democrats were in charge, we brought a bill to the floor that would legalize same-sex marriage. I'm sure you all remember that. The bill failed, a progressive bill, maybe what I think will be probably the progressive issue of our time as history looks back on this period in time. Democrats brought it to the floor, couldn't generate enough votes to see its passage. When the Republicans were in charge only a year later, one of the great ironies, I think, they put the bill on the floor. There were a handful of Republican votes to join most of the Democrats who passed the bill. Now, why couldn't that have happened a year earlier? It was the same, for all intents and purposes, the same senators, the same bill for the most part, slight changes, the same issue, the same public opinion around the issue. Relatively broad support for the issue. Different governor, by the way, and that was a significant change, and that can't be minimized. But the point is, there was no working across the aisle, working in a bipartisan fashion to find common ground on major issues of the day. The 2010 election comes. Governor Patterson decides he's not running for office. Attorney General Cuomo runs, wins handily, with platform of making government work again, right? When we had reached the epitome of dysfunction. In the state Senate, change again happens. The Republicans reassume control of the majority. Narrow majority, 32-30 at the time, but Republican control once again. With one difference. I, from my perspective, and three other Democrats, at the time, after those elections in 2010, said, we have to try something different. This is not working. Government had not been working, particularly over those previous 2 years, but even going back a few years before that. We need to do something internal to the Senate to dramatically change how the Senate operates from the perspective of moving away from the hyper-partisan gridlock that had come to, I think, define our Senate and our legislature in many ways, and again, what has come to define Washington in recent years, and find a way to actually govern. There are times for elections, there are times for politics, but for most of those 2 years, it's a time for governing, and we have to find common ground. We have to negotiate. We have to compromise. Those are not dirty words, despite what some on the two extremes of the political spectrum might indicate. That's what a legislature is supposed to do. It's supposed to negotiate. It's supposed to compromise. It's supposed to find common ground on issues of the day. So I and three of my Democratic colleagues in late 2010, early 2011, before the beginning of that new legislative term, form the Independent Democratic Conference, which meant that the four of us separated ourselves from the Senate Democrats, not from the Democratic Party. And there was some confusion at the time and some head scratching. What does this mean? Is he a Democrat? He's a Democrat. I'm a Democrat. I always have been. But we said there has to be a better way to do it. So we moved away from the Senate Democratic Conference and said, we want to find a way and create a Senate that can work in bipartisan cooperation to advance the major issues of the day. So these last 2 years, that's exactly what we did. We worked very, very closely with Governor Cuomo, a Democrat, to advance his legislative agenda, whether that be the Marriage Equality Act, whether that be the property tax cap, whether that be two on-time balanced budgets without raising taxes, without borrowing, being fiscally responsible, enacting ethics reform, sweeping ethics reform, enacting the Recharge New York power program that is so critical for business retention and development, and a whole host of other issues. And at the same time, work very closely with the Senate Republicans who were in the majority for the previous 2 years on much of the same legislative agenda. And it worked, right? I mean, the notion of dysfunctional Albany, for the most part, went away. Michelle and Fred and others hadn't been writing about it that much. We don't hear about it in the media. Why? Because things are happening. Government is getting done. And by the way, at the same time, we have a governor who's at 70% approval ratings in the polls. Why is the governor at 70% approval ratings? Because government is working. Government is functioning. The people of the state, by and large, think that what's happening in Albany is positive, that their business is getting done. You know, we agree on some issues, we disagree on some issues, but by and large, we're moving forward in the right direction. Then we get to the elections of a couple of months ago. What happens? A change again happens. The Republicans lose, drop below the 32-seat margin that it takes to maintain a majority. Now what do? We have three conferences. Right, we have the Senate Republican Conference, the Senate Democratic Conference, and an Independent Democratic Conference. And a conference is a caucus, by the way. All the word conference means is a caucus, a group of legislators who meet together, who develop an agenda together, who work together. That's all that means. So now what do? We have three groups instead of the traditional two, and virtually every legislature in this nation, certainly in this state, in this nation, we are accustomed to, and this is because of the two-party system that we have, we are accustomed to, in the vast majority of legislatures, having a two-conference system. There are Republicans and Democrats in a Senate in Georgia or Michigan or California, right? Or an assembly or a House of Representatives or a House of Delegates in Maryland or Virginia. Democrats, Republicans, they meet together, they have agendas, and move them forward. We don't have that here in the state Senate anymore. We have two conferences of Democrats, two separate conferences of Democrats, and a conference of Republicans. Very similar, by the way, to the way most other Western democracies function. Most other Western democracies are parliamentary democracies, parliamentary legislatures. They have multiple political parties, which we don't have, but the governing model is very similar. So whether it's in Canada or England or Israel or Germany, we have coalition governments where one, in those cases, political party does not have enough votes to create a majority. So you have to come together. You have to have a coalition. And here in the state Senate, as we approach the new legislative term here in 2013, we had to do something that was different than what has ever happened before. Neither of the three conferences had 32 votes to govern in the traditional governing fashion, so you have to form a coalition, either between the independent Democrats and the regular Democrats or mainline Democrats, or the independent Democrats and the Republicans, or the Democrats and Republicans. What has happened, as you all know, is the Senate Republicans and the independent Democratic Conference have joined in a majority coalition government to partner, to set the legislative agenda, to continue the progress of moving the state forward, and perhaps most importantly, to do everything we can to ensure that we don't slip back into dysfunction again. So practically, what does that mean? What does the new Senate look like? What does it mean, and how does it work? Mechanically, the leader of the Senate Republicans, Senator Skelos, the leader of the Independent Democrats, Senator Klein, jointly govern the Senate. So there, every day that we meet in session, both conferences through our leaders must sign off on the calendar for the day. The calendar is mechanical document that determines what bills are taken up for debate. Joint sign off from both leaders, both from two different parties. This is what really makes us so unique. So both parties through these two conferences have an equal opportunity to make sure that their priorities are advanced and heard. And perhaps, you know, in a Senate that is as closely divided as ours, and I neglected to stress that point earlier, as long as I have been in the Senate, it has been a very, very closely divided Senate between Democrats and Republicans. And in all likelihood, it's going to continue to be that way, at least over the next several years. So right now, there are 33 Democrats, elected Democrats. There are 30 Republicans, but the conferences, as they line up, there are 31 members of the Republican Conference, 5 members of the Independent Democratic Conference, which makes for a 36-seat majority coalition. So each day in the Senate, we have an opportunity to work in bipartisan fashion to advance a legislative agenda. How has it worked? How is it going to work? How has it worked so far? Interestingly enough, the most high-profile issue that we've taken up already, the first day of session, the gun control legislation that has been such a high a priority of Governor Cuomo, actually, I think, underscores how this majority coalition is already working and how I think it's going to continue to work. Regardless of how you might think about the gun bill itself, let me just spend a minute to give you an idea of how the current version of the bill was put together, which is now law. The governor made very clear, I think we all know, from ever since the tragedy in Connecticut in December, that he was very anxious to do something about assault weapons, these military-style assault rifles, that New York State had already had a fairly aggressive ban on, certainly more so than most other states, and the federal government's assault weapons ban expired back in 2004, so there is no federal law right now. But he made it a priority of his agenda this year to close loopholes in that piece of legislation. And that was the starting point for discussion. The Assembly, by the way, again, controlled by Democrats, has passed a number of versions of these bills year after year after year. Senator Skelos, the leader of the Senate Republican Conference, shortly after Governor Cuomo began discussing and having negotiations around a new gun law for the state, they came out with a alternative piece of legislation, one that focused primarily on increasing penalties for crimes committed with handguns, illegal handguns, which, you know, here, whether we're talking about here in the city of Syracuse or any other upstate city that has a gun issue, the vast majority of crimes are being committed with handguns, and of those handguns, they are illegal. And what is happening is, as we all know, guns are being brought in from outside of New York State and crimes are being committed with them. So we have, too, the Senate Republicans and others, particularly others in upstate New York, as I and others have, said, well, we've got to do something. The problem is, the real problem here is, or as important a problem as any, is this issue of illegal handguns. So the bill that Senator Skelos had proposed included a significant increase in penalties for crimes committed with the use of illegal handguns. His bill expanded what is known as Kendra's Law. Kendra's Law has to do with the mental health community reporting to law enforcement their professional opinion as to whether or not they believe that someone could pose a danger to others and or themselves through the use of a firearm. In that bill, a provision known as Mark's Law that Senator Ritchie had sponsored, Senator Ritchie from the North Country, that would impose a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole for someone convicted of murder of a first responder. Governor Cuomo referred to this in his new law as the Webster provision as a result of what happened on Christmas Eve outside of Rochester. So to the notion of a majority coalition, if the Democrats solely had been in charge and had focused solely on the assault weapon piece, I'm not sure that we would have had as expansive a gun bill on the books as we do today. So right out of the chute this year, you had priorities advanced by a Democratic governor, you had priorities advanced by a majority coalition partner in the Senate, and it made for, I think, a much more comprehensive law, a much better law that we have going forward. That's the model that has already worked. That's the model that I think is going to continue to work throughout, first and foremost, the budget process that we are now in. Governor Cuomo's budget proposal was delivered to the legislature about 3 weeks ago. Senator DeFrancisco and others are conducting the Senate Finance and Assembly Ways and Means Committee public hearings on the budget. The Senate and the Assembly will adopt one house versions of a budget in response to Governor Cuomo's proposal, and then certainly hopefully by the end of March we'll come to an agreement and pass an on-time budget, a fiscally responsible budget that closes a $1.3 billion budget deficit in a fiscally responsible manner. And that will be done on the Senate side of the legislature through this majority coalition of independent Democrats and Republicans doing the business of the people. So I think we are off and running. I think it's going to work. And at the end of this two-year process, I think we will have certainly a model of how governing can take place and how we can move beyond the hyper-partisan gridlock that unfortunately has become all too commonplace and actually get the business of the people done. So we're off and running with government, and perhaps with that we can be off and running, Sandra, with questions on anything I've talked about or anything I've left out. Ed, while you ask your question, or do you call on people or do I call on people? While you do that, I'm going to get my glass of water.
Okay. All right. For those of you, for guests, questions, we're open for questions. Raise your hand. I try to make my way around the room and keep your questions brief and in the form of a question. Thank you. We'll start with Mr. Sesniak. I'm going to hand you the microphone, which I don't normally do. I'm going to trust you with it.
Thank you. Senator, this won't be a commentary, so just be a question.
Okay.
I thought you did a very good way of showing how we got to where we are today. But the focus is on the relationship between the Independent Democratic Conference and the Republican Conference in the State Senate. How does it work between the Independent Democratic Conference and the Democratic Conference in the Senate? Hopefully the need to reach across in Democrat and Republicans is just as important between Democrats and Democrats. So.
It is. And in fact, I neglected to mention in the analysis of how the gun bill became law, if it were not for the Senate Democrats, the mainline Senate Democrats, all of whom voted for that bill, there were not enough votes in the majority coalition to pass the bill. So while there is a majority coalition between the IDC and the Republicans, the minority Democrats, I think their ability to participate in this through this new coalition structure is really greater than any other minority conference has been under the old two-party, two-conference structure. And I think it's identified most significantly already by the new gun law.
Senator, I was wondering, as I make my way to the next hand that I saw, if you could give us an update on where the Senate and the Assembly are on the issue of redistricting reform. That was one of the kind of basics there in the dysfunctional, the Brennan report and all of the rest.
Right.
So could you give us an update?
Yes, sure. Well, the quick answer is it's now going to be up to all of you to decide, because we have just put a constitutional amendment before the voters to change the Constitution. I'll expand a bit. As we headed into the most recent round of redistricting, which, as I think all of you know, has to happen after every census, every 10 years, to reconfigure legislative districts in both in Congress and in both houses of the state legislature to reflect changes in population, so that we continue to represent about the same number of people, you know, in our legislative districts. Many of us believe that an independent redistricting process, or as independent as possible, is the way to go, was the way to go, and is the way to go in the future. I had sponsored, back when we were in the majority, by the way, one of the failures of the Democratic majority in 2009 and 2010, I had sponsored legislation that would have created a truly independent commission. We didn't pass that bill. We should have passed that bill. Now, whether it was constitutional or not is another issue. There are critics of my legislation at the time, and I was carrying the legislation that was the priority of good government groups like the League of Women Voters and Citizen Union and Common Cause and so on and so forth. The opponents of that legislation said that the Constitution in this state is very clear that only the legislature can adopt a redistricting plan. Okay, I mean, ultimately the courts would have decided that question if we had passed that law, which we did not. So moving into last year, the redistricting process was done by and large the way it has always been done, with one significant exception. Governor Cuomo, to his credit, said that he is not signing off on a new redistricting plan unless we have significant reform of the process moving forward. Again, the process is not going to happen again for another 9 years, but what we have done in the interim is the legislature, both last year and this year, to amend the Constitution on any question. An amendment has to be approved by two consecutively elected legislatures and then considered and approved by the people of the state. So we have completed the legislative component of amending the state constitution. We passed it last year. We have passed it actually just a couple of weeks ago in both the Assembly and the Senate, and now it will be up to the people of the state to decide in November. And if that happens, if the referendum succeeds, then we will move toward a much more independent process than we have ever had in the state in the past.
Bravo. Thank you.
Senator, with the passage of the recent gun law, there are many gun owners who support the new law. However, they feel it's a slippery slope. Could you articulate your belief in what Second Amendment rights are?
I don't, in answering this question, I would just share with you that I have been as big a supporter of sportsmen and hunters in my 8+ years in the Senate as anyone, and will continue to be so. I don't believe that this is a slippery slope issue. I've heard that. Many individuals have expressed that issue to me, and while I am not an attorney, I don't believe that the bill that was considered and approved by the Senate and the Assembly and signed into law by Governor Cuomo is in any way, shape, or form unconstitutional, and by that I mean a violation of the Second Amendment. Ultimately, that's what the judicial branch of government will rule on. I mean, I believe there have already been the beginnings of legal challenges to the new law. And ultimately, it's not my job to decide that. It's the judicial branch of government's job to decide whether something is constitutional or not. my understanding of how the bill was drafted by the governor and by his attorneys is that it is, in fact, constitutional and not in any way, shape, or form a violation of the Second Amendment of the federal Constitution. Okay?
Senator, one of these evenings about a month ago, a cold evening, a petitioner came to the House from the Working Families Party on campaign finance reform. I signed the petition, and they asked to send letters to you. They saw you as an obstacle on campaign finance reform. Could you talk about that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. The issue of campaign finance reform is an issue that has not been addressed in Albany for years. In fact, the basis in law of our campaign finance laws were actually written when Nelson Rockefeller was governor. So this has not been an issue that has been addressed in a long, long time. It's an issue that needs to be addressed. There are a whole host of areas in state law and a lot of reasons why we need to address campaign finance. Unfortunately, the most significant reason to address campaign finance reform actually has nothing to do with the state of New York. It has to do with the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the Citizens United, which is a federal issue. And only Congress can address that, or some Supreme Court in the future can certainly revisit and reverse their decision, but that's not my responsibility. So in the state of New York, we need campaign finance reform. We need significantly greater disclosure of how dollars are being spent. I, in my four elections, know very well how the issue of a lack of disclosure of these independent expenditures are. I've had somewhere around $6 million, I think, in direct expenditures spent in by candidates and campaigns who have been running against me over the last several years. So I know exactly how significant this issue is and why disclosure is so important. We need to do disclosure. We need to do, I think, a reduction of campaign limits. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, I think anyway, if I were to tell you that in running for the state Senate, you could give me as an individual a contribution some three times as large as you could give Senator Schumer or Senator Gillibrand running for the federal Senate. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. So reducing campaign contribution, strengthening the enforcement of the Board of Elections for campaign law violations. Many of the scandals that we've seen in Albany over the last several years have been around campaign law violations. So there's significant work that needs to be done there. The question that is still an open question in my mind, has to do with the issue of public financing of elections. We don't have public financing of elections in the state. Some areas of the state do. The city of New York has a public financing component. My concern, and I have not, and am not, my intention is not to oppose, my position is not in opposition, but my position is one of concern when we have had, I have been through in this economic crisis some of the most difficult decisions that we have had to make in Albany as it relates to balancing budgets. And the spending cuts that we have had to make, particularly in areas of healthcare and education, have been extremely, extremely difficult. I have had superintendents of schools, and I represent a number of rural school districts, that have said to me, you know, Senator, unless you do something about education aid, we are not going to be able to offer anything that is not mandated in law by the state. Full-day kindergarten is not a mandate in the state of New York. So I have actually had superintendents say, we can't afford to do full-day kindergarten anymore unless we get this school, not to get off on a tangent, but unless we get this school financing issue resolved. So my concern with the public financing component of elections is that we have had to make so many difficult decisions that Right now, I think we have higher priorities that we need to fund. If we can hire back many of those teachers, for example, that have been laid off over the last couple of years because of the economic crisis, I think that should be our primary priority and others as it relates to taxpayer dollars. That's not to suggest that elections aren't important and that campaign finance reform isn't important, because it is. It's critically important. I have been concerned that, part of my job is to make sure that we are spending your dollars, taxpayer dollars, as wisely as possible. That's not to say that elections are not a wise use, but we have a lot of extremely high priorities that have been suffering to a great degree over the last couple of years as a result of the crisis. So, okay?
Senator, I'm confused that we've had several speakers here who have told us that the only way to change the Constitution is by having a constitutional convention, and yet you're about to propose that be done. When in 2000, I believe it was, Carl McCall stopped Tier 1 from contributing to their retirement, which is literally now killing the counties and local governments because of the high retirement costs. That can't be changed because it's now part of the Constitution. Why can't the Senate and Assembly take this up? Is it because it affects your staffs?
No. You have a couple of different issues in there, so let me try to address them all. The Constitution can be amended in two different ways. I'm not sure who would have told you that it can only be changed through a constitutional convention, because that's not the case. That's one way the Constitution can be amended. And our Constitution actually requires the question to be asked every 20 years. Every 20 years, there has to be a question on the ballot in this state. About whether or not we hold a constitutional convention. That's going to come up again, I think, later in this decade. But that's only one way to amend the Constitution. The other way, as I indicated in the redistricting response, on any issue, if two consecutively elected legislatures, so last year was an old legislature, this year is a newly elected legislature, all right? As long as in consecutive legislatures the constitutional amendment is approved, the same question, approved in both the Assembly both those years and in the Senate both those years, that question then goes on the ballot. It hasn't amended the Constitution yet. It just puts the question on the ballot, so you will decide in November, in the case of redistricting reform, you will decide whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. As it relates to pension reform, there are a number of ways to address the issue of costs to our local governments and school districts. One has already been addressed last year in the legislative session last year, when the legislature and the governor created a new pension tier, Tier 6, a much less generous public employee pension tier. The problem with Tier 6 is, you know, this only applies to new employees. No one is hiring. Cities, towns, counties, for the most part, school districts, you know, in this economic crisis, aren't able to hire new employees in the less generous pension tier. So this has, Tier 6 has a great degree of savings, but years down the road. So what do we do now about the city of Syracuse and Onondaga County and towns and villages and school districts? Well, the governor in this budget proposal that we're reviewing right now, so it's not a completed budget yet, we're still reviewing it. He has proposed what is referred to as pension smoothing. It is a tool that would allow, if we adopt, would allow local governments to lock in at a lower contribution rate now, and it's kind of like a fixed mortgage versus an adjustable home mortgage. You fix in at a certain rate and spread the cost of those, in this case pensions, over the next several years. Actually, under the governor's proposal, over 25 years. So it would help local governments and school districts. Now the question is, what happens later on? And I'm sure many of you have read Mayor Miner's comments on the issue, County Executive Mahoney's on the issue. So there's a lot of disagreement right now as to whether that's a good thing for governments or not. but that's something that we will address. By we, I mean the Senate Assembly and the governor, as the budget process continues.
Senator, in your new role in Economic Development Chair, can you tell us about some of your legislative priorities?
Sure. Thank you for raising that. I am, as part of the new majority coalition, or was asked to chair the Senate Commerce, Economic Development, and Small Business Committee. And my priorities will be, by and large, similar to the kinds of issues that I've already been working on before I was chair of the committee. In the last 2 years, for example, we enacted in Albany, and we're waiting for the final sign off from the Common Council and some issues locally, but a land bank piece of legislation that it has had tremendous success in other states with cities that have gone through challenges over the last several decades in regard to their economy. So I think that's going to be a tremendous help to the city of Syracuse and others in the state. I was the lead sponsor of the Historic Rehabilitation Tax Credit, which is making a significant difference in terms of our downtown redevelopment. The Pike Block, many of the other projects here are being done through the use of those historic rehabilitation tax credits. That's a program that expires next year, so we have to, at a minimum, extend the program. I'm hopeful that we can enhance that that program. So those are the kinds of issues that I'm going to focus on, and the broader goal certainly is to make sure that we continue down the path of changing the business climate in New York State to be more business friendly, so that businesses, particularly small businesses, retain and create jobs here in upstate New York.
Good morning. Nice
morning.
To see you.
Good to see you.
There's been a court case that I know you're well aware of concerning financial equity for school districts throughout the state. Nothing has happened with that. And I'm wondering what your position is, as well as what its status is in the Senate. Obviously, what's going to happen, if it ever comes to be, is it is going to shift money from suburban schools to city school districts. My second question is regarding redistricting. If the referendum passes, who will be responsible for appointing an independent body? Is it going to be the two leaders of the House, both houses, and the governor? Or how is that going to work?
Yes, the leaders of the legislature would appoint an independent, a balanced. Well, no, I think it's an improvement over the way it's been. It would be an improvement, but you will all decide that in November. The issue of education funding. The courts did decide the campaign for fiscal equity back in 2005, I think, and then in 2007, the one budget that Governor Spitzer delivered to the legislature and right before the fiscal crisis actually did create a new state aid formula, a foundation aid formula that was in compliance with the Court of Appeals decision, the Campaign for Fiscal Equity, and continues to be in compliance with the court decision. The problem is that the year after we did that, the fiscal crisis hit. So at that point, Governor Patterson, and every year since, in budgets since, has imposed what is referred to as a gap elimination adjustment on all school districts. So even though the foundation formula is in compliance with the Campaign for Fiscal Equity, it's as if we're providing resources and then through this gap elimination adjustment to help close the massive state deficits, we're sort of taking back what was given. Not really, but in a sense, that is the practical result. So what we have been doing, I and other legislators who represent, and I represent much of the city of Syracuse now in the new Senate district, but I also have a number of rural districts, and when it comes to schools and school aid, the challenges faced by urban and rural districts are very, very similar. So I and other legislators, particularly upstate legislators of both political parties, Democrats and Republicans, have been working in each successive budget, and we've been successful to a degree, to accelerate the elimination of the gap elimination adjustment, if that makes sense, okay? because that is the reason why we're, the reason why that is the focus, that is disproportionately affecting the big five school districts, City of Syracuse, and the rural districts. So the sooner that we can get rid of the gap elimination adjustment and get back to the foundation formula and only the foundation formula as the means of distributing state resources to schools, that will bring us into, I mean, we're technically in compliance with the court order, but it will bring us into fairness, school district fairness in terms of state support for schools.
Hello, Senator.
Hi, Fred.
I was interested in your comment comparing the situation with the independent Democrats to a parliamentary system, and the thought just occurred to me, the question occurred to me, is this possibly the beginning of a new party in the state? And my question is, do you think, on the one hand, is this a temporary development that will last until bipartisanship reigns in Albany and then there'll be no need for this anymore? Or are you actually, you know, being encouraged or seeing steps that could lead to the creation of sort of a third, you know, party in New York State with that attracts, you know, candidates, that will have its own convention, that will, you know, act like a real party in the sense of like the Canadian Liberal Democrats, or, I mean, you have ideological differences from the Democrats now.
Right. We have a couple of thoughts there. We, as you know, we have other parties in this state, a conservative party, a working families party, independent party. The issue of those parties' success at the ballot box, I think, has less to do with what we do or don't do in the state Senate, and has more to do with the laws that currently govern how they operate. In this state, as you know, I'll refer to them as the minor parties, law allows minor parties to cross-endorse candidates of a major party. So I have for the last year, for example, ran as a Democrat on the Democratic line, but also with the Working Families Party endorsement and with the Independent Party endorsement. The issue of further strengthening those parties, I think, has more to do with if we were to ever change the law and not allow that to happen, so that independent so that third parties in this state would have to run their own candidates for elective office. I think that probably would have more to do with the strength of those particular parties than anything we're doing in the state Senate. Specific to the state Senate, the other thing is this governing model is right now specific to a very closely politically divided state Senate. I am not sure that something like this would necessarily developed in the assembly where there's a clear where one party has a clear majority over the other, as it has for the last several years. So I think unless this model gets beyond, now if we start to see this, for example, in county legislatures around the state, and in other on other governing bodies, then perhaps yes. But right now, I think it's unique to the Senate and making sure the Senate functions. The other thing I think that is important to note, and Senator Skelos and Senator Klein participated in a breakfast yesterday morning that was hosted by Crain's Business Insider down in New York City, a business publication in New York City. Both of them agreed on an interesting point, and they said that the goal of the majority coalition, Senator Klein said, you know, is not to turn Republicans into Democrats. And Senator Skelos said the goal is not to turn Democrats into Republicans. We are all, for one reason or another, we choose to be members of a political party for all sorts of reasons. And the parties to which we belong have certain philosophical beliefs and platforms and agendas. So it's while the governing model in the Senate may be blurring the differences in terms of governing, the goal isn't necessarily to do away with political parties. It's to make sure that we have a governing structure that once elections are over, that we can govern in a bipartisan fashion. And you know, as not to repeat the example of the gun bill, but I think that's a perfect example where the two parties were coming from pretty significant differences on what they thought ought to be part of that law. And if not for this kind of bipartisan cooperation, which can happen, by the way, and should happen, theoretically, should be able to happen in any legislature without necessarily forming in the rules of the Senate what we have formed. We took that extraordinary step in the state because out of lack of confidence that it would have happened unless we, enshrined it in the rules of the Senate for the next 2 years. Did that answer your question? I don't know if I got off topic a little bit, but I think that's, but I don't think, just to come back to where you started, I don't think the issue of our two-party system in this state is really rooted in a national two-party system. So to the extreme of your question, would we ever see anything such as in Canada or the other, or in parliamentary democracies? That's not anything that's going to be driven by something we do in the state Senate. I think that would only be driven or ultimately be driven by whatever happens or doesn't happen in the national discourse. And perhaps the American people will, perhaps there will be a time where a significant third party movement will happen out of, I presume, would be out of frustration of the two major parties, but that's really a national debate, I think, as to whether that would ever happen or not.
One of the lingering issues that's been bothering a lot of people in this state for a long time is upstate, downstate conflicts with who's getting the short end of the stick and all this. And it's good to hear that your coalition has brought about perhaps greater collaboration in a lot of areas. What impact has it had on this upstate, downstate thing?
Well, that's actually, from my perspective as an upstate Democrat, that's really one of the most significant pieces of the majority coalition. When we as Democrats were in the majority in 2009 and 2010, I was one of only four Democrats in the Senate Democratic Conference at the time, north of Westchester County. So, over three quarters of that conference was made up of New York City Democrats. The leadership in the Assembly, Speaker Silver from Manhattan. So the geographic balance issue is very, very important. And I think that's one of the significant strengths of this particular majority coalition. The Senate Republican Conference is based primarily on Long Island and in upstate New York. The Democrats in the state Senate, while there are fortunately a few more of us than there were upstate, it is still at least most of the Democrats still come from New York City or the metropolitan New York City area. So, look at our local situation here. The fact that we'd have a Democrat who's chairing the Economic Development Committee in the Senate and a Senate Republican who continues to chair the Finance Committee, that's not only is that good bipartisan cooperation, but it is a much better geographical balance than we saw a few years ago.
Senator, it seems to me that your independent conference is like a swing vote in the legislature. So you must be getting a lot of pressure from both sides. Can you comment on the pressure in the way you see it and feel it?
I thought he was going to say you get a lot of presents from both sides.
Presents? No. Now, come on, Sandra. Ethics.
Joking. Yeah. Although I do hope you guys go out to lunch together once in a while.
There was a lot of pressure when we first formed the Independent Democratic Conference 2 years ago not to form the Independent Democrat. I mean, anytime you change, we all say we're for change, right? Whatever it is. When you actually want to do something about it, there are a lot of interests that don't want to see change, right? That want to be protected by the status quo. So there was a lot of pressure over two years ago other Democratic senators in particular who did not want to see that happen. And then fast forward to this new majority coalition. Sure, there were those who continued to try to resist that. But, the bottom line for me is I was elected and continue to be elected to do what I think is in the best interest of the people that I represent. Not what other senators happen to think. That's not my, they're not my constituency. You are. So in my judgment, I mean, you know, right, to one degree or another, we elect people to trust in their judgment, since we, you know, we can't all vote. We're not a state with referendum on the ballot all the time. So you trust my judgment to do what's in your best interest for 2 years. And if I've done that, you'll ask me to continue. If I haven't, then there will be someone else. But so that's the only, and there, so as a result of that, virtually all of the pressure that was felt on me personally was not from here, was not from my district, was from Albany and the Albany, some of the Albany-centric mentality. Here, for the most part, there's been very little pushback whatsoever, even among the most ardent political supporters of mine, Democratic political supporters. His follow-up question was just about the issues. I think that time will tell, but I think you have, you know, whether it was the gun control bill, minimum wage, which is an, I'll just use just one because I know we're running late. Minimum wage, which was an issue that was not taken up last year, despite overwhelming support among the people of the state, 80%, I think. So I think that's something that is going to happen this year and be supported by the new majority coalition.
Thank you, Senator Valesky, and I do hope that you will come again, not too distant future.
Thank you, everybody.